From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. We're going to start out with a case, an unsolved case that was most recently featured on America's Most Wanted. In fact, I'm going to take a little blurb off of AMW.com and tell you that on March 5th, 1993, Gail Parker was admitted to Keno Community Hospital. Her daughter, Danielle, says that Gail suffered from bipolar disorder and had stopped taking her medicine. However, hours later, the hospital allowed Gail to leave. We'll talk about that, wearing only a blue bathing suit and a long white coverall. Danielle said the hospital never called any family members to come and retrieve Gail, who eventually got in a taxi. Police say later Gail was seen around 1:30 a.m. at a convenience store at East Golf Links and South Houghton Roads. The next morning, Danielle says three bicyclists found Gail's remains on the outskirts of Tucson in a desert area south of Broadway on Barclay Park Loop. Authorities say she died from a blow to the back of the head and hypothermia. There's some DNA evidence that has come forward recently, and we always want to talk about unsolved homicide cases here and see what we can do to help the family members. And tonight we're going to start out with Danielle Parker, Gail Parker's daughter. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Welcome to the program. Sorry to have you on such unfortunate circumstances, but one thing that I'm always amazed with families, whether it's 1993 or 1973 or however long it is, families never stop until they get answers, and it's answers that they deserve. Let's get going here. Tell us, first of all, a little bit about your mom, and then we'll get into the case.
Sure. Well, yes. I mean, I know that you went over the facts of the case, and the last 24 hours of her life certainly sound like something out of a novel. But I do want it to be known that probably about 90% of the time, my mom was a very happy, normal, functional person. It was just that recently, in recent times before she had died, I had left home to start my career. I was a young lady, and 25 years old, just starting out in the business, moved to L.A., and she went off her medication, and that is what led to her, unfortunately, being in the hospital for bipolar disorder. So that's something that I kind of wanted to get out there, is that, my mom was taking lithium. She was functional on it. She was a wonderful mother, a great humanitarian, a writer, a social activist. So she was a very, very valuable person and a great loss to the world and society. So so basically these were kind of an aberrant situation where everything that imaginable that could go wrong just went wrong in this particular day and circumstance. So I've been on a quest basically for 16 years to find her killer, and because, she was such a wonderful mother, and I know that if the situation were reversed, she would never stop searching for my killer, and for my deep, obviously, love and affection for her, this is something that I'll do until my dying day.
Let's start out a little bit with the mental health aspect here.
Sure.
Mental health and the understanding or misunderstanding of it, in effect, right down from law enforcement to John Q. Public, is a big part of many of these cases. A lot of people don't understand the mental health aspect. They think that someone who comes into a hospital who is later released and family members are not notified, that's a big part of this case, in my opinion. And I've only talked to you for 5 minutes. Let's talk about the education aspect here. Were law enforcement and medical authorities aware of your mom, or was this the first time that they had anything to do with her?
Oh, this is the first time they had anything to do with her, and that's why. I mean, I think, you bring up a very interesting point. I think that people should know more about, mental illness and the fact that, instead of kind of, you know, a lot of people feel very sympathetic towards people that, you know, have a body cast on, a broken arm, a broken leg, something that you can see, and they're very scared to talk about, you know, the problems that are going inside in someone's head. And, you know, my mom did suffer from bipolar disorder. She was diagnosed at a very young age, and it was a very sad, tragic illness to have, but it was caused by multiple childhood traumas that she had undergone. And but was really, you know, what was really critical here, and what I think, you know, is very important to get across, is that, you know, there's a shame that is associated with this type of a disease. So, you know, even my mom was in denial of what was wrong with her and tried to hide it because it was something that she felt very ashamed of. And there is no shame in having, people that have cancer are not ashamed of the fact that they have that. It's just something that is wrong with some circuitry or some wiring or something in your body. And my mother had, there wasn't any reason for the police to be informed about her for any particular reason. She wasn't in trouble or anything like that. What had just happened was that she had become depressed after I left home. And like many mothers do, when their 20-something-year-olds go on to move to another state and start their lives, she suffered from something that most, that even normal people, that were not bipolar, suffer from, which is basically empty nest syndrome. When, yeah, you know, the child leaves home and I'm an only child, she became very, very despondent and felt like her purpose in life kind of went along with me. And I think that that's where the despair came in. And unfortunately for her, she couldn't find anything else that fulfilled her as much as being a mother. So, it's a very, very sad, tragic thing. She tried to do all these things like volunteering at Tucson General Hospital, and she read on this radio show called Sun Sounds. She was basically reading stories to the blind and anything that she could do to try to divert her attention. But she really did feel lost after I left home. And that's not a mental, that is actually a human issue. That's a social issue that many women suffer from and go through. And I think that that is what my mom was going through at the time. And she, you know, unfortunately, it led to her having a breakdown. And, you know, the hospital, by letting her go, put her in a very dangerous circumstance, which eventually, unfortunately, led to her murder. Because when you let a person who is mentally unstable wander around the desert in the middle of the night, something bad is bound to happen. So that's unfortunately what happened to her.
Danielle Parker is here, and we're talking about the unsolved murder of her mom, Gail Parker, and there's a link in the show notes to the A&W website. We're going to get into the investigation in a minute here, Gail, but I want to talk a little bit about the family, you in particular.
Sure.
I lost my father last week. And he died from natural causes, but there's something that I like to call the blame game. I sat back for a day and I thought, geez, you know, maybe if we'd but the thing is that it was his time to go, and it went that way. Your mom was murdered, no fault of yours, but did you blame yourself at all?
Oh, of course I did. I wrote a lot of, I'm a writer, a journalist by training, and I wrote poetry. One is called Why Did I? Why Didn't I? It was like, basically I was asking myself all the woulda, shoulda, coulda questions that we all ask ourselves when we put, when we try to figure out why it is that a loved one is lost. And I would like to express my sincere condolences for your loss, because it doesn't matter how you lose a parent, no matter how it happens. It's a horrifically sad part of your life, and I'm very, very, very sorry for your own loss. And I wanted to say that to you. So and as far as my mom goes, I was feeling very guilty because I felt I knew she was having some adjustment problems to my leaving home and living in L.A., and I, you know, came home as much as I could. I used to fly back and forth between L.A. and Tucson. And they didn't have direct flights, so I'd always have to fly through Phoenix. So I was really going to exceptional lengths to stay, you know, to not let the distance come between our relationship. And we spoke on the phone every day, and I tried to speak to her about any concerns that I had about how she was feeling and try to, you know, point her in directions of interest of how she can fill her time, just didn't seem like anything was satisfying without me around. And, you know, she came to Los Angeles quite often to visit me, and we, you know, I mean, we really had a beautiful, wonderful relationship, and she was my best friend. And so I think that, you know, and I think what I eventually discovered, you know, after I stopped blaming myself, is that there really wasn't anything that I could have done, because the reality is that I had to grow up and I had to eventually move on with my career, which was definitely not in Tucson, Arizona, for what I do for a living. And, you know, this was a horrible freak incident, and you know, the hospital definitely assumed some responsibility. I mean, they should not have let a person in a state of mind like that leave their facility. So, you know, they put her in danger, and, you know, there was nothing that my father could have done either, because he put the, she was entrusted in their care. And we were not notified until after it was already too late, before she had disappeared, right up, you know, it was way after she disappeared. So basically, you know, I'm not going to blame myself. I can't. It's, it was not my fault. It was not my dad's fault. It was the hospital's fault, and it was whoever did this, whatever monster that decided to take advantage of a poor, sick woman. It's just a real tragedy in every single way possible.
That's a shame for sure, and there's no doubt about it. The hospital blew it, and in 1993, and even today, the misunderstanding and the what I call the fear of liability for institutions like hospitals, police departments, social workers, whoever, that when you have a mental illness, there has to be quite severe circumstances to have, say, a 72-hour hold or something.
That's right. There are involuntary holds where if somebody is deemed to be a danger to themselves, they can put you in, you know, in hold for a period of in between 24 and 72 hours. I don't know what the law is in Canada, but that's what it is. And, you know, I think it's a state-by-state law. And in this particular case, they had decided, actually, interestingly enough, the person that had evaluated my mother was on depressive medication herself. So the people, it's really kind of ironic that the person that was evaluating people in the mental health arena was also apparently suffering from depressive illness. So interesting, but you know, once again, it's not something that I can go back to and fix. If I could, I would do it in a heartbeat. The only thing that I can do is fight for justice, and I can fight to try to find the animal that killed her. And like I said, it's my life work now, and it's what I'm going to be doing and for the rest of my time on this earth, is along with helping crime victims. That's something else that I'd love to talk to you later about.
Sure, you bet. Authorities say that your mom died from a blow to the back of the head and hypothermia.
Yes.
She was found by three bicyclists on the outskirts in a desert area. So did the authorities or the investigators at that time, and my spider sense tells me a little bit that there might have been a ball dropped when it came to the investigation itself here, but
quite a few of those, actually. Yes, the detective that was assigned to my mom's case, her name was Karen Wright, was in charge of the investigation from the beginning, and within the first 24 hours of the investigation, which is a critical time, when, you know, it's either hit or miss, and mm-hmm. it could really mean the difference between finding the person and not finding the person or persons that were guilty. She took the day off. When I had come, I found out about this at 2:00 in the morning on a Saturday morning, which was March 6, 1993. And I immediately booked a flight for myself from Burbank to Tucson. And I remember getting to Tucson and going. My dad picked me up at the airport. We went straight to the police department. And when I asked the detective who was on duty, because it was already Sunday by then, I said, "Where's the detective?" And he said, "She's taking the day off." And I said, "What do you mean she's taking the day off? My mom hasn't even been gone for 24 hours." And since I had been a journalist, I was very familiar with police procedure and the way that things worked. So I said, "This is the most critical time in the investigation. How can you be telling me that she's not here, and basically said, well, it's a Sunday, and it's her day off, and, you know, basically the crime scene was, they went over it, and, you know, there's nothing really more to do at this point, so we'll continue with the investigation tomorrow. So I was, you know, besides being in complete total shock, what had happened is, and the difference that this could have made was that the last place that my mother was seen alive was at a Circle K convenience store. I don't know if you have them up there, but this was a quarter mile away from the crime scene of where she was found in South Tucson. And they had, convenience stores have always had these surveillance cameras when, because they're, you know, they are targets for robberies. And they had a 24-hour tape that ran in a loop, and because the police decided, or because my investigator decided to take the day off, they didn't get to the Circle K in time to get the tape of the person or persons who followed my mom outside from the Circle K, because they do believe that she was followed from this convenience store. This is the working theory. And at some point, she was attacked, and they hit her with some type of blunt object, probably a large rock in the back of the head, with enough force to cause a subdural hemorrhage. So had the police actually gotten to the Circle K convenience store in time, we may have had a visual on the people or person that was involved in the crime. And, you know, but because it was, after 24 hours in the investigation, that opportunity was lost. And then there are a lot of other drop balls along the way, but that was the most significant one, because after that, basically the person, you know, was on the way and found their way to Utah. We were able to trace them to Utah, and then the trail went cold. That was, you know, a month after she died. They found her purse in a lake in a city called Kanab, Utah, and her credit card, mobile station credit card, was used in Phoenix, Arizona on the day of her murder. So basically the people went from Tucson to Phoenix to somewhere in Utah, and that's where the trail went cold. So it's so that's the last that we heard about that, and that was in April of 1993, and there haven't been any leads that were significant since that time. So it's, you know, it's a really sad thing. It's, you know, very, very frustrating. And there is a little bit of hope that technology will catch up, and, you know, we can talk about that, but there are, we have a national DNA database in the United States, mm-hmm. and you have to have 13, quote, markers to be put into the national database. The DNA that they found off my mom only had 7 markers, so hopefully the technology will catch up and we will be able to find out some more information in the future. But now, unfortunately, there isn't enough to go on, so we have to go on appealing to people and putting together a significant reward, which we do, which is we're up to a $100,000 reward for the apprehension, prosecution of the perpetrators involved in this crime.
And if you have any information, make sure and call AMW's toll-free line at 1-800-CRIME-TV. That's 1-800-CRIME-TV. Danielle, I'm going to read something again from the website.
Sure.
It says, I will never know how my mother died. I will never know if she was in pain or if she went right out when they hit her. I will never know if she had moments of comprehension, and I will never know if she said her own personal goodbye to me. And one thing, just in our last 3 minutes here, that I want to applaud you for, and I applaud all victims of crime that come on my program, is that your strength and your determination will eventually bring answers. Justice is served in many different ways, and I think you're serving justice greatly by fighting the fight that you are. Sadly, there was inexperience and maybe laziness with the police detective. The hospital totally blew it. You know, those kinds of things happen, but you sound like a gal who's determined, and I give you full marks for that, and we will work very hard with you to help how we can. I'll give you the last word.
Well, thank you so much. I do want to, you know, tell a little bit about the human aspect. I mean, look, this, you know, I know that I sound like a tough, determined person, which I am, and it's only because I loved my mom that much. And if my mom had not been such a wonderful, caring, loving person, and, you know, and instilled me with, you know, self-confidence and strength and certain qualities that I possess, I wouldn't have the ability to do what I'm doing. And I really can't express, you know, how, you know, first of all, how grateful I am to you and your show and people like you out there that are trying to help crime victims, because it is such important work, and I don't think that, you know, there are nearly enough places that give crime victims a voice, so I applaud you for what you do. And it's, you know, and you know, I just have to say that, you know, it is a really, really tough thing for, you know, a girl at 25 years old to lose their mother, who was their best friend and closest confidant. And even though it sounds like, you know, I'm really tough and that I've, you know, done well over time, this has really, you know, put a huge hole in my heart. It's been something that, you know, has never healed, probably will never heal, and, you know, has left me with great scars. And I just try to put, you know, a brave foot forward so that people can see that you don't have to, you know, that being voiceless and, you know, kind of giving up and lying in bed is not the way that you get things done. So what I do is I take my energy and I channel it into trying to do something positive. So I do this in honor of my mom, who was a wonderful person and a great you know, human being and a wonderful, wonderful mom above everything else. And thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to tell her story and my story. And I hope that something comes of it. And please do contact AMW.com if you have any information. And like I said, there is a $100,000 award for, you know, for anybody who comes up with information leading to the prosecution of the perpetrators. So, you know, if anybody can come up with something, I really... I call on you to please do the right thing and let the police know, or let the Tucson Police Department or AMW know what happened, because my dad and I would really like to see this person, you know, go to jail for what they did.
Danielle, I will stay in touch and we'll stay on top of the story.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
No problem. We'll talk soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Make sure and check out the show notes, and there's a link to the AMW story on this. We need to get some answers, and it's because you folks out there that are listening is the reason why we can get answers in these cases and justice can be served. We're going to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk about an organization called Survivors in Action. My name's Dana Pretzer. You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. Survivors in Action, there's a link in the show notes. Their webpage is www.survivorsinaction.com. Pretty simple. Have you or a loved one reached out for help from your local shelter or coalition and refused help? They can certainly help you with that. No victim left behind. It's a 501(c)(3). I always get that screwed up. Nonprofit victims of crime organization. And tonight we have Alexis Moore and Randy Rosen on the air together to talk about it. It's always nice to have both of them on the show, because what we can do to help victims is a great thing, because they don't get as enough help as they should. Good evening, ladies.
Good evening.
Hi, Dana.
Let's start with Randy. Both of you are victims yourselves, and the gal that I just had on the show before you, her mom is murdered, or was murdered, and she's a victim because the case is unsolved, and yet she's talking about other ones and other families, and it always amazes me is how victims can dig into their inner strength and do what they can to help others. And both of you rightfully could have said, we're victims, we've had it, the system failed us or the system helped us, but we're not going to do anything more. But you're nonstop helping people now, and I really appreciate that. Randy, tell us how you got involved with Survivors in Action.
Thank you, Dana. I was originally, I founded Women's Legal Resource as an outlet from being in the family law court and experiencing a lot of judicial corruption and misconduct with my own dissolution case. I am a victim of domestic violence. I experienced a lot of just dramatic events that took place in the family law court, which was really disturbing. I was involved in a psychological evaluation under Evidence Code 730, and my ex-husband had people lie under this particular psych eval, and I could have lost custody of my child because of it, but I fought back. I personally wrote a motion to dismiss the psychological evaluation based on fraud and with intent to commit harm, and the judge, which was Judge Henry Walsh, said to me in the courtroom on record, "I don't take this very lightly," and did nothing about it.
Hmm.
Nothing.
And
that's when I realized that it doesn't matter what, there's no justice in family law.
The judiciary, Randy, and we're going to go to Alexis now, they don't like to be criticized. They don't like to be spoken about or talked about. Yet we keep hearing these nightmare stories, not only your guys' stories yourselves, and Alexis, you too are a victim, but we keep hearing them over and over and over again. And I can remember a while ago myself doing an interview about domestic violence, and I called it an epidemic, and I was criticized for that, but it is. You know, we try to educate the best we can. We try to not re-victimize people, but it happens. We try to get everyone from the beat cop right up to the counselor, to the judge, to understand it more, but it keeps going. Alexis, what more can we do, and how does Survivors in Action help with the process, or at least try to get it on an even keel?
Well, just like Randy said and you said, I mean, domestic violence and many, many crimes, they are leaving victims behind. Unfortunately, today there's so many, Dana, who are doing their best to advocate for themselves in the system, but our justice system is set up so that without an attorney, without a lot of experience or knowledge, you will be left behind, and that's what Survivors is doing. We're filling in the gaps. We're filling in for those that maybe they fell through the cracks for whatever reason, victim witness or the prosecutor or law enforcement or somebody out there maybe. You know, just there are a lot of busy folks, and they have a lot on their plate. They may have just not dotted an I or crossed a T, and it's our job to fill in. And I have to admit that Randy and I connected, and she's living proof that the average person, just like me, you, and our listeners, you can do it, but it's a lot of hard work. And at least with the two of us together, with other volunteers and folks like yourself, we're telling the listeners today that there is hope. You can reach out for help, but it's a lot of hard work. And it is helpful when you have folks like us who do have real-life experience. There's nothing worse, in my opinion, than reaching out for help to somebody that has no idea what you're going through. And they tell you they do, like, oh, I know how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
It's, to me, probably the worst words and the use of those words that anyone that's been victimized can hear, because we know they don't, unless they really do. So the reason why Survivors in Action is here is so that no victim is left behind. It's inexcusable. There's no reason for anyone who's suffering, who's been a victim of any crime, to fall through the cracks, and especially not today with the Internet, where we can be connected with millions of people in a matter of seconds. And that's why we're here, and we're letting folks know we're here. And we're definitely going to help whoever we can, and if that means day or night, we're definitely here online, SurvivorsInAction.com. To ensure no victim is left behind.
Yeah, you have a sex offender registry that you can search on here, a GPS petition that you can look at, a violent offender database. There's all sorts of things. Education is one thing. Getting the word out is another thing, Alexis. And we'll get to Randy in a second. I understand there's going to be a segment on Good Morning America tomorrow?
That's right. We just confirmed, actually, just moments ago, I did confirm with the producers.
Great.
They taped me last week, and there will be a segment on domestic violence and the use of GPS technology with restraining orders and domestic violence. Includes an interview that I did, and it will definitely be on tomorrow. So Good Morning America tomorrow with Alexis A. Moore and Survivors in Action, and it was a great opportunity, and I definitely hope that it goes as well as I think it will. For those out there who have never learned or know about GPS, it's a good time to tune in.
Randy, I use the term re-victimization quite often, and all the rape victims that I've had on my program, domestic violence victims, law officers, defense lawyers, DAs, cops, you name it, when they hear that, and I agree with the, you know, I know how you feel, or I understand what you're going through. Unless you've been there, you've done that, you don't, and every circumstance is different. How do we educate the folks when it comes to domestic violence, because when it comes to the media, we really don't hear much about it except in the high-profile cases, Rihanna and Chris Brown, and that kind of, you know, it, as tragic as that was, but that kind of Hollywood schmaltz, it tells one side of the story, but it certainly doesn't tell the other side of the story, because most people can't afford Mark Garagos as a lawyer or have $100,000 worth of jewelry seized by the police on you. A lot of it is just Joe and Mary six-pack, and Joe decides to beat the crap out of Mary, and she can't get help anywhere.
I agree, Dana. I myself have been re-victimized just recently. I have an ongoing case that's active, and it's really, really frustrating when just the regular person or woman or man who doesn't have the financial resources to obtain legal counsel, and there aren't very many pro bono attorneys that are willing to donate their services, it's extremely, extremely frustrating. And I can only say this, is that the more education, the more information that you gain, the more knowledge you gain, just researching and learning about everything you can about the laws with domestic violence in your state. And if you're fighting yourself, that is the most important tool. And just familiarizing yourself with custody laws, restraining order laws, everything. Just familiarize yourself with the judges. You know, if that's the only way that I for myself, have learned not to be re-victimized. It's really, really tough. And often reaching out to an advocate that's within the family law court can help you, you know, have someone there. And that's what we do in Survivors in Action. We will go with you and sit with you in the courtroom. And no one ever has to go through this alone.
No, nor should you.
Right. And it's really, really difficult to know that the judge will look at someone who's in pro se and not give them the same kind of treatment that a lawyer would have.
Yeah.
Often, a lot of the motions that I brought up in court myself, the judge would look at me like I was, you know, an idiot. But the one thing that I did learn is that when I did research and prepared a motion, I knew that it was on the button. I knew that I was citing cases. I knew I was citing law correctly. I knew that my language was right. I knew that my punctuation was right, and that he couldn't look at me like that. And it was hard, but I did it. And there were many times when I wanted to just give up and say, the hell with it.
Mm-hmm.
I just, you know, just let it go. What can I do? But when I look at my daughter and I saw her face, that's where it gave me strength. And I said, okay, now I've got to continue on. So I know that when people are listening and they're pursuing this themselves, just know the more information you gather, the more knowledge you gain, the more powerful you become.
You know, amen to that, that's for sure. And when we talk about victims, especially domestic violence, sometimes we neglect the family aspect of it, the little kids. We neglect the stalking aspect of it. Yeah, okay, there's a restraining order or no contact order, but those are sometimes not worth the paper that they're written on. And it continues on where the victim, Alexis, is continually harassed, whether it's through cyberspace, an email, Facebook, all the social interaction that you can get on the internet, to just driving by, to whatever. And if you're living in a small community with a small police force who don't have a lot of people working or they don't understand, it just is a vicious circle. Let's talk about that a little bit, Alexis. The things about stalking, these sorts of things where people may hear the term, but they just don't understand it.
Right. Nowadays, especially, we have what's known as traditional stalk. You know, like you mentioned, you drive by, you walk around, and you see the perpetrator or the batterer. And then today we have cyber stalking, which involves the use of technology to stalk. And that can be creating email accounts using the victim's name, or sending spyware viruses via like a Hallmark card or a similar e-card, which the victim believes is from a relative or a loved one or a friend or a coworker, and they open that up, and it allows the batterer the opportunity to have access to their computer. I mean, there are so many ways now that a batterer or a stalker has control over the victim. Even though you leave and you close the door and you think you're going into shelter, or you think you're evading this batterer who's you know, hopefully behind you, maybe not beating you black and blue anymore. Now they're stalking you. And I think for the most part, unfortunately, the majority of women and men that I work with that are stalking victims have to tell folks that being stalked is worse than probably actually being beaten up, because there's no end. The bruises and the broken bones, they heal. But looking over your shoulder all the time happens to be one of the most devastating and most just the impact it has on a person is a day and a night. It never quits. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This individual could be lurking out there, regular, whether it be they're traditionally stalking you, you know, driving by, or they could be around your workplace or your job or school, that sort of thing, the child's school. Or you have to worry about what's going on online. So it's even worse for some than it is actually to be beaten up, because there is no end. There's no end until the person actually stops. And the restraining order does nothing to stop this.
And as strange as that sounds, you're right. And Randy, I'll ask you, you know, the bruises heal, and that shouldn't happen, and it's tragic that it does. But when you look at the mental aspect of it, the mind is something that's very hard to heal. And when you're looking over your shoulder, or you jump out of your skin every time the phone rings, or you wonder who's texting you or who's emailing you. This internet, it does a lot of good things, but boy, is it evil when it comes to a lot of others.
I absolutely agree, Dana. I constantly, for the past 8 years, have been looking over my shoulder. And now I live with family because I just didn't feel safe living on my own. And the one thing that I really have to stress is that, you know, when you start your family, you have family. I'm so grateful that I do have family. And my mom sat with me every day in the court that, you know, we had to make. She met with me and sat with me in every court appearance that we had to make over the last, I was in court for 4 years, 5 years on my dissolution.
Jeez.
And, you know, just knowing that. And then the support system I have is phenomenal. However, not a lot of women have what I have. I'm very fortunate. That is part of the reason why I started Women's Legal Resource, was to give women who didn't have access to the information that I had and give it to them, make them aware, show them how to fill out a restraining order, show them how to make a complaint against a judge. So I always continue to look over my shoulder. That will never cease. That will never, I mean, it may just go away slightly, but I never let my guard down, ever. And my daughter, I didn't want to raise her that way. I wanted her to be strong and stand up for herself and just be aware of her surroundings. And luckily, her elementary school is directly across the street from where we live, which is great because I can still eyeball her. But my daughter doesn't live like that. She's very free and open and strong-willed, very opinionated, but doesn't live in the same, she doesn't have that same mindset that I have of fear. You know, children are fearless, although she witnessed a lot of the abuse. But she won't, you know, let a bully her, thank God, you know,
right.
and that happens daily in schools. And when she first met a bully, she said, back off, I'm not going to take it. So, and that was just from her seeing what went on in the family environment, and just knowing how to protect herself. And that was just innate in her personality. So the wounds never do heal. And
no.
And Alexis will agree with me, they're there. And sometimes some of those wounds will never, ever go away. And hard to continue and building new relationships because of the wounds. But the resources that women have today, there's no excuse why they have to remain victims. There's no more victimization here.
You're right. And it, a lot of it is the courage to be able to come forward, and it's advocates like you guys who are able to instill that courage in the victims. And I'm just looking at some of the statistics, Alexis, on the webpage. You have them about workplace violence, stalking, sexual violence, identity theft, elder victimization, same-sex domestic violence, domestic violence. It's just incredible. In fact, it's mind-boggling. And again, I'm going to use the term, and I'll get criticized for it, the epidemic. And, you know, it's survivors in action. And what you're doing, you and Randy, that is going to help with that epidemic a little bit. Like with the, you know, with epidemics, we can put a mask on and rubber gloves, but that just masks the problem from getting to us. We have to do something about the problem. And Alexis, we're down to about 3 minutes here. I'll give you and Randy each about a minute and a half to tell us what you think we should do more to try and solve this epidemic.
Well, more and more victims of crime need to feel that they can reach out for help. And unfortunately, like we talked about with cyber stalking and some of the crimes involving the use of technology, they're not considered crimes. All 50 states have not included cyber stalking in their stalking legislation or statutes. So it's up to the victims to stay strong and to reach out to groups like Survivors in Action and know you will not be re-victimized here. And we need you to be brave, because in order for services to improve, we need to know what's on out there. And that's the key. Victims listening tonight, you can reach out to us anonymously and tell us what you've experienced, what you think needs to change, because Randy Rosen and I both cannot be in all 50 states at the same time. So it's very, very important that every victim listening, or their loved one, or their friends, coworkers, speak out. Tell us what's happening in your neck of the woods so that we can do our job and ensure that you're not left behind. And we need your help to do that, because we can't be in all places at one time.
Well said. Randy, I'll give you the last word.
Thank you, Dana. I agree with Alexis. I think that more women and men especially need to stand up and be brave and reach out. We won't know how to help you unless they do that. We are working really hard on getting the word out and working with legislators about the GPS trackers in California. We work diligently with other organizations to see to it that, you know, information about domestic violence is out there, sexual abuse, sexual assault. But the one thing that we have to hear from are the victims. We won't be able to help you unless we do hear from you. You won't be counted unless you stand up and fight back. That is the only thing that I can say that I know that has worked for me. And I reached out, and I got it, and I started fighting on my own. It's possible. No one has to be hiding behind a rock anymore. It's time to stand up and be counted.
Absolutely, and you both say it very well. And I'll stay in touch. The website is www.survivorsinaction.com. Randy Rosen, Alexis Moore, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be in touch. Bye-bye. Okay, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come back with ADA out of Los Angeles County, author, television personality, radio host, you name it, Robin Sachs, with her weekly Nothing But the Sachs segment. And I want to tell you right now, we're going to give away some books tonight. We're going to give away a couple of books to those that are listening live. Robin's new book is called Predators and Child Molesters, What Every Parent Needs to Know to Keep Kids Safe. And we're going to give a couple of books to those that can't listen live but do listen on the podcast or watch the television feed of the program. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. It's our weekly Nothing But the Sachs segment. You know, Robin Sachs is a ADA out of Los Angeles County, an author, a television personality, what else she do? She hosts the Justice Interrupted, or one of the co-hosts of Justice Interrupted on Tuesday nights on Blog Talk Radio. I hear she's a pretty good cook. What else can I say? Listen, what we're going to do tonight, Robin's new book, Predators and Child Molesters, What Every Parent Needs to Know to Keep Kids Safe, I think what we're going to do is we're going to give away a couple. And I'm going to throw out the ground rules right now, because we not only have people listening live, we also have people that listen to the podcast, so after the fact, and we have people that watch the television feed of the show on cable TV up here in Canada. So I'm going to do it this way, and if it's okay with Robin, what we'll do is, instead of phoning in, I only have one phone line, and I've done that in the past. People complain, oh, I couldn't get through. I'm going to take emails. I'm going to take two emails, or whoever's listening live, email Dana at scaredmonkeys.com, Dana at scaredmonkeys.com, and the first two that I receive, and in the heading, you have to put live, you will win a copy of the book, Predators and Child Molesters, What Every Parent Needs to Know to Keep Kids Safe. And then I'm going to do the same thing for those that are listening either on podcast or watching on TV. Put podcast or TV in the heading, and again, Dana at scaredmonkeys.com, send me the email, and whoever's email gets through to me first in both categories will receive a copy of the book, and I thank Robin and her publisher for that. How are you, ma'am?
My pleasure. I'm great, thank you.
The News is still depressing as always. All we have to do is just turn it on and take a look, and there's more craziness and more insanity and more violence, and the automatic weapons are continuing, and the guns and you name it. But now we're starting to hear more about the dopey judges that are just, you know, they're basically letting people walk for no particular reason other than just, you know, O'Reilly did a big feature on this last year around this time of the Connecticut judges that were giving out probation for multiple offenders and stuff like that. And we're starting to hear about it more, but more across the board, not only in the United States, but up in Canada. Is it the judges that we should be blaming, Robin, or is it the system needs an overhaul a little bit when it comes to sentencing?
Well, I think it's twofold. I think that you have to look at both pieces of the puzzle. One being the what is getting filed part. That means what role is the prosecutor, what kind of charges are being filed, and then looking at what the judges are doing. I think, you know, when I was in the DA's office filing cases, sometimes there were cases, very often, that I felt like, you know, it's barely within the policy and within my purview of being able to file, but I'm not going to be the son of a gun that's going to let this mother blank go free, so I'm going to file charges anyway, and knowing that I was going to have a rough road for a conviction in terms, you know, not that it was unethical, not that I couldn't do it, not that it was illegal, but it was going to be a tough trial. And so in those cases, a conviction where there may be something that would be perceived as a really weak sentence like probation is a huge win when you weigh the alternative being no case being filed at all and the guy completely walking. So I used to, you know, kind of think of, okay, well, are we lowering the standard of what the sentences are, or are we convicting more people than we ever would have? So I think you have to look at it on both ends before we can just jump to what's going on.
Yeah, and exactly. And a lot of people don't understand the system. A lot of them are friends of victims, or they're victims themselves, or family members of victims, and they see the system and they think that the person needs to go to jail for a very long time. There's maximum and minimum sentencing across the world, and they don't understand. But then when you see the judges, the way that they handle some of these cases, in particular some of these child molestation cases, you talk about, and that was your cup of tea and still is, you talk about rehabilitation. I live in a country that is a rehabilitation style of country when it comes to sentencing and crime and punishment, where some states are, some states aren't. And you and I both know that a child molester can't be rehabilitated. I'm going to get a bunch of email over that. But it's that sort of thing, I think, that makes the people angry, and they call for, you know, the judges that are appointed should be elected, and they should be the people to decide, and all that sort of stuff. And is that what's going on, or am I just rambling here?
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I totally agree with you on the premise that child molesters cannot be rehabilitated. You know, there's different kinds of child molesters. I think you and I both would agree that it's very different having a 15-year-old having sex with a 19-year-old versus a 15-year-old having sex with an 80-year-old, or a 19-year-old having sex with a 7-year-old. I mean, these are all different kinds of crimes. The uh-oh feeling in your stomach, this makes me sick and ill, is different, and we would want the courts, and the courts do treat those kinds of things differently. However, having said that, it is, I mean, yes, would it be nice for people to go to prison for long periods of time for heinous acts they commit? Yes, and absolutely yes, triple yes. However, I think the real life issues, we can all sit here and look and say, hey, this is what I would do, and I've said it and done it before if I was judge, jury, and lawmaker too, what I would do to make things different. However, the fact of the matter is that it's 12 people in a box at the end of the day that get to make the decision. And if we don't feel confident that our case has enough to be able to secure a conviction with 12 people, then it doesn't matter what sentence we think we want, because if we don't get a conviction, we get zero sentence. So you have to always weigh that into, okay, well, this is what we can get versus this is if we get nothing at all. And a lot of people are really quick to say, well, then I don't want anything at all and play hardball. But the fact of the matter is having people registered as sex offenders, being able to track people, being able to GPS people, be able to do all those things have huge benefits. And not to mention, a conviction on the record is corroboration for the next victim.
Yeah.
And as you and I both know, and if our philosophy is correct, these people can't be rehabilitated. They will do it again. And the second time, unfortunately, will be a mandatory life sentence, and we'll have the corroboration we need, and they'll spend lots and lots of time, hopefully, behind bars.
Robin Sachs is here with her Nothing But the Sachs segment. In fact, we're giving away a couple copies of her new book, Predators and Child Molesters, What Every Parent Needs to Know to Keep Kids Safe. Those that are listening live to the program, email me now, dana@scaredmonkeys.com. Put live in the heading, and if you're the first two people to email, you'll win a copy of the book. And those that listen on podcast or watch on the television feed do the same thing, but put podcast or TV feed on the email, and a little bit later on this week, we'll send some books out to you. Last week, Robin, you and I were talking about Drew Peterson and all of the media work that he did prior to his arrest, and by gosh, living up to Drew's standards right from the jail. He does an appearance on the Today Show, and it's just, it's got to be incredible. It looks like Joel Brodsky is sticking to his strategy. Is the more media, the better chance my client will have to get off. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, that's the card he's playing. I think, you know, let him go and have at it. I don't think either Mark nor Joel can help themselves at this point anymore. I don't think we're going to expect to see any change of strategy anytime soon. And frankly, it doesn't really matter. The damage has been done. But frankly, I'm pretty pleased with him going out there. Every time he shows his face, every time he makes any statement, it's one more piece in the puzzle that we can use to impeach him later on, gives us a look at his character. And I think everyone at this point, at least the general consensus that I get from the people who talk to me out there in the just regular world and not in our crime world, is kind of like, why are we even talking about this case? Isn't he like gone and in jail forever yet? And I don't think it's going to hold much weight in terms of the jury.
Speaking of why are we even talking about this, are you a fan of John and Kate plus 8?
You know what? Let me tell you, I was at Joan and Kate and Octomom and all those people.
Okay.
I'm just grouping them all in the same category.
Yep.
Like, I'm mortified, really,
yeah,
for our country and for our level of newsworthiness. I mean, give me a break already. The fact of the matter that these people get the front page of People and Us and, you know, and every other swag magazine that's out there, and it's just a testament to the shallowness of our society. And, you know, I was sitting last week in San Jose, ICAC conference, listening to FBI people, commanders in the FBI, and people from all over the country talking about how to protect kids in the internet and the exploitation of children and the child welfare system and foster care system and all of these issues that, you know, need our attention and need our help and need media attention. And, you know, I look at my Facebook that has people who are missing and people doing amazing work on these causes, and yet at the front page of our magazine and media are dealing with the extramarital affairs of a reality show. It makes me sick.
It absolutely is. And when you talk about exploitation of children, there's many different forms of it, and those poor little kids are being exploited every time they're on TV, every time their mother or father does something stupid. And what John and Kate Plus 8 can do, and I talk about it in my commentary tomorrow on the webpage, is turn the damn cameras off and start looking after your children. Robin Sachs, I'll give you the last word.
Well, all I have to say is that whenever we see a case like this, is that we should be blogging, writing. You know, Dana, what you're going to do tomorrow in your review and your, you know, Dana's perspective and what have you. Those are the cases and causes that need our attention. And the only way for us to really get that attention is to continue with everybody who listens to your show, my show, and everything else in between. Is to ignore that media and to continue responding with the media that needs attention.
Absolutely. They want to do a reality show. They should have been here with their cameras today watching me battle with my lawnmower. Boy, you could add 15 minutes of great TV there.
I actually would have paid for that myself,
David. All right, Robin Sachs, thank you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Okay, sounds good.
And that's our weekly Nothing But the Sachs segment. And yeah, poor John and Kate plus 8. It's the plus 8 that I worry about, those two knuckleheads. need to get a life or get a room, or maybe that's what they've already done. I'm not sure, but it's starting to become tiring, that's for sure. That's it. That's tonight's show. Make sure and check out our webpage at www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to the show live. You can listen to podcasts of past shows. Leave comments, the daily commentary, whatever. And remember, tonight, we're giving away two copies of the book Predators and Child Molesters, What Every Parent Needs to Know to Keep Kids Safe. If you're listening live, email me, dana@scaredmonkeys.com, dana@scaredmonkeys.com. I'll pick the first two emails. Actually, I haven't even opened the email yet to see what's come through. And if you're listening to the podcast or watching the TV show feed a little bit later on next week, you still can email me with the heading podcast. And we'll certainly, if you're the first couple of people to get a hold of me, we will send you copies of the book. It's a great book. Robin's a great author and a great guest. That's it. That's tonight's show. We'll see you again next week here on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.